Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 23rd, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. As we're coming into the week of the Democratic primary and we're moving into the 2008 general election, we actually have events that are that should be at the forefront of our thinking, much more so than the idiotic little striptease that Obama did yesterday on the choice of the vice presidential candidate. In a statement issued on Thursday, Lyndon LaRouche warned that we're actually closer to World War III than to the November elections, and we're facing what he called a Cuban Missile Crisis in reverse. In addition to the danger which still exists of a provocation by Vice President Dick Cheney and his British controllers to use an excuse to attack Iran, or the spin-off of the destabilization of Pakistan into broader war in Asia, LaRouche identified what he called the provocations against Russia via George Soros and British intelligence Saakashvili government in Georgia as the leading edge of this danger of a nuclear World War III. While most Americans are victims of psychological warfare run through the propaganda mills known as the mass media, which would have you believe that the confrontation in the Caucasus region is one of Russian brutality against the brave fighters for democracy of the so-called Rose Revolution in Georgia. In reality, you could call what we've seen unfolding a British imperial game plan to destroy Russia. On our program today, to provide the history of this war danger and to give you, our listeners, what you need to know to act to prevent the outbreak of World War III, we have with us Rachel Douglas from the Russia Bureau of the Executive Intelligence Review, a scholar of Russian history and someone who's very much involved in working with Lyndon LaRouche to get out his ideas both in Russia and also to get out to the American people the reality of what's going on there. We'll also be joined by LaRouche Youth Movement member Leandra Bernstein from the LaRouche PAC editorial staff. So, Rachel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Harley.
Now, there's a myth which you and I talked about before the program, which has been perpetrated, that what we're seeing is the courageous people of the small democratic nation of Georgia standing up for their freedom against the bullies in the Kremlin. What's the truth to this?
Well, I think the truth was summarized very succinctly by Lyndon LaRouche in an interview with Russian television this week, where he said what we're seeing here is part of a British-led operation with American support, which was intended to crush Russia by a series of encirclement actions. And he cited not only the attack on Russian peacekeepers and the civilian population of South Ossetia, and I think we can take some steps in this discussion to demystify what that was about. He also cited the accelerated conclusion this week of the deal between the United States and Poland for the stationing of anti-missile systems, components of an anti-missile defense program in Poland, which Moscow has repeatedly stated it perceives correctly as a strategic threat, a threat to its strategic nuclear deterrent under current doctrine. And thus, LaRouche continued in his discussion with the Russian TV interviewers saying, quote, "I think we're headed for the potential of a new missile crisis, comparable to what happened in 1962, but worse." That's the Cuba Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. And he said this is the danger because we're on the verge both of a general breakdown of the world's monetary and financial system, and in such a period, we are looking at the guns of August, the threat of World War III. Now, I know that is not what people have heard on the radio and TV and the internet this week. And I want to shed light on what you've been told and why, both from the standpoint of this larger strategic context, the strategic reason for what happened. That's what we'll focus on, I think, in this discussion. But also,
In that light, I think that it's important to make the point right at the outset that the American people are being lied to, both in terms of the day-to-day local situation, but also having been denied this broader picture.
Yes. I think it's dramatized if we look even at the, if you will, small-scale day-to-day lies. And I just pulled from our ample files of the last 2 weeks two examples. One is the first day of the fighting on Friday, August 8th. Now, I happened to be traveling on that day. I was in rural Kentucky, actually traveling with a friend from Moscow. And as soon as we checked into a hotel and found out what was going on, we contacted her family in Moscow to find out what the coverage was there. It so happened that her husband monitors television from all over the world, and he reported the following, that first day, August 8th, he had seen grabs from Georgian television of their own artillery batteries shelling the capital city of the region in Georgia called South Ossetia. The shelling took place at night. As many as 2,000, perhaps many more, people were killed as they slept in their homes by this shelling.
Now, Rachel, let's just to take a little bit of time so people really get this picture. Most people don't know what South Ossetia is. Can you just shed a little light on that?
I can, and I would like to go into more depth than that later on in the program. But I'll just say now that within Russia, as within other countries which until 1991 had been for various periods of time, either since World War II or since World War I, or in the case of Georgia, much longer, since 1801, parts of the Soviet Union or earlier the Russian Empire. Within these nations, Georgia, Russia, Azerbaijan has this phenomenon, others do, there are what are called autonomous districts, or autonomous republics even. Mm-hmm. People may have heard the name of one of them, Chechnya. That one's inside Russia. South Ossetia, Abkhazia, and Adjaria are three so-called autonomous regions within Georgia. They were carved out as such during the Soviet period on somewhat ethnic lines, and they had very ample autonomy for managing their affairs within the Republic of Georgia, within the Soviet Union. Now, I want to get later to what happened with them in the 1990s when the Soviet Union broke up, but that identifies what they are.
Okay.
And there had been fighting in South Ossetia, civil war, actually, in Georgia, in the early 1990s. It ended with a truce policed by peacekeepers from both Georgia and Russia.
And
what happened on the 8th of August is the Georgian peacekeepers opened fire on the Russian peacekeepers, backed up by shelling, as I just mentioned, of the whole capital of the South Ossetian region by Georgian artillery from within the rest of Georgia. And what I was going to say is that what our observer in Moscow reported was that this footage of the Georgian shelling of Skhinvali, the capital of South Ossetia, he saw first as a grab from Georgian TV, and an hour later he was watching CNN and the BBC, and he saw the same footage, except the voiceover that was illustrated by this footage said, "Today, Russia invaded South Ossetia and the rest of Georgia." And it was illustrated by the film of the Georgian shelling of Skhinvali. That's number one. Number two is something that many people may have heard the other day. And I'm just going to read you an Associated Press wire, which was at the top of news roundups all day on the 15th of August. And it said, headline, "Georgia can, quote, forget regaining provinces," close quote. The lead sentence said, "The foreign minister of Russia said Thursday that Georgia could forget about getting back its two breakaway provinces." Now, that sounded to me not like the language that the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, customarily uses. He's a very skilled, experienced diplomat. So I looked it up. I read the transcript, I listened to the audio so there could be no mistake. And what had happened in the interview that he gave that day in Russian radio was that the questioner asked kind of a leading question and said, Minister Lavrov, there have been three presidents of Georgia since the Soviet Union. All three of them, with very different political backgrounds, ended up attempting a solution of the situation with South Ossetia by force. So maybe this is somehow genetic. Maybe all Georgian presidents will always attack South Ossetia. And Lavrov replied, quote, if that is the case, then I think that talk about the territorial integrity of Georgia can be forgotten. Because forcing Ossetia or Abkhazia to agree that they can be returned to the Georgian state by force will be impossible. So you see the difference, right?
Well, it's totally clear.
Yeah. So the bigger picture is who in the West, who in Georgia, who amongst Georgia's backers wants a conflict with Russia and why? And a conflict of the dimensions that Mr. LaRouche referred to in his interview with Russia Today this week. And I want to tell people that a very good reason to be a subscriber to the EIR is that we tell you this. We warned back in June in an article that I wrote on the 20th of June, for the 20th of June issue of EIR, that there was a move in preparation coming particularly from the British Foreign Office and those in the European Union who have a vision of the European Union as an empire to, as it was put by one source, unfreeze the frozen conflicts in this area around Russia's perimeter and get a higher level of tension going in which the European Union would come in and show its stuff, strut its stuff as the big guy on the block and as a new postmodern empire, as one of the British-based think tankers put it. So we warned that this provocation was coming. But the roots of it, Harley, you can look back to 1992. Just after the Soviet Union as such broke up in August 1991, August to December period, the U.S. State Department adopted a policy memorandum, and it was widely understood that this was under Vice President,
Bush 41.
But under Cheney's guidance in defense.
Defense Secretary.
Yes, and this was his department. So that memo declared that the reconstitution of the USSR or any reemergence of Russia as a strong nation could not be tolerated. And I'll just read you this one sentence because it's so striking. The DOD memo of 1992 said, "Our first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival, either on the territory of the former Soviet Union or elsewhere, that poses a threat on the order of that formerly posed by the Soviet Union. This is a dominant consideration underlying our regional defense strategy and requires that we endeavor to prevent any hostile power from dominating a region whose resources would, under consolidated control, be sufficient to generate global power. These regions include Western Europe, East Asia, the territory of the former Soviet Union, and Southwest Asia." Now, of course, the rub is, what's your definition of hostile? Hostile to what? Huh? And so you can see, if you look really at what happened in Russia during the 90s, that the thinking, and again, what's in that Cheney-era DOD memo, is absolutely typical of British geopolitics going back for 200 years. It says that the threat is a strong Russia, not that Russia's going to up and be a superpower and start bullying and attacking people, but rather the potential that Russia, because of its own unique history, could represent an obstacle or a counterpole to the imperial tyranny known as globalization.
Okay, and I want to take that up in just a second, Rachel. I just want to identify for our listeners, this is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, the 23rd of August, and you're listening to Rachel Douglas. We're discussing the danger of World War III. When was this article printed that you covered this?
Well, there, I just referred to two articles. In June 20th issue of Executive Intelligence Review from this year, I have an article called European Union Presses Offensive Against Russian Interests. And in that article, we wrote that even though the Lisbon Treaty, and I know you've discussed that on a number of programs, had been defeated by the vote, the no vote in Ireland on June 12th, nonetheless, those who advocate the European Union as an empire, which would be the arbiter of relations throughout East Central Europe, were escalating their efforts to achieve that. And they
this is another example of LaRouche and his publications being well ahead of everyone else. And I think that's important to point out because our listeners, as you said, can get subscriptions to the Executive Intelligence Weekly. It's available. And this is a track record now, as Rachel's about to, the quote from Cheney shows, we have a track record going back 30-something years on these things.
That's right.
Now, Rachel, I want to just pick up this thread then on this idea of an empire, a fight to, you might say, contain or break up Russia that goes back, you said, 200 years. What's the start of that? That's about the same time as the American Revolution overturning the British Empire.
Yes, I probably should say 300 years, because it was in the first 25 years of the 18th century, around 1700 to 1725, that America and Russia shared a mentor, and that mentor was Gottfried Leibniz. As I know you've discussed in previous programs on the history of the American system of economy and the American intellectual tradition, Leibniz inspired and was a correspondent with many of the people who were the fathers and grandfathers of the generation of the American War of Independence against the British Empire. But in that same period, Leibniz was an advisor to Peter the Great, the Tsar of Russia, and designed for Peter the government structure that Russia implemented, designed the Academy of Sciences that Peter founded in 1725, just 9 years after Leibniz had died. And that those processes launched the industrialization of Russia at such a pace that by the late 18th century, Russia's pig iron output was greater than that of Britain. Russia, there was a specter of Russia becoming a strategic obstacle to the sun never sets on the British Empire ideology and practice, which got consolidated in 1763 with the end of the Seven Years' War in Europe and the ascendancy of the British East India Company over British policy. But let me.
While you're mentioning that, I just want to. Russians know this history, right?
Many Russians do. Aspects of it are lost. One of the things that is so exciting and beautiful about Lyndon LaRouche's direct dialogue with leading intellectuals in Russia is that he has made a commitment to saving the historical memory of these important relations so that things which were eclipsed in during the Soviet period, because you know, what really happened in the 18th and 19th century didn't necessarily fit with the Marxist or the Soviet Marxist version of how history worked, and so they were swept under the rug, or, you know, you could have an academic specialist in some area write extraordinarily insightful works on the relations between President John Quincy Adams and Count Rumyantsev in the early 19th century, but you couldn't really elevate that to say it was critical to what was happening. So we've tried very hard to revive the memory of this history, both here and there. But you know what the 18th century history brings to mind is exactly the point today. because the drive from the British Foreign Office, from Cheney's circles, from the thugs that work in the service of both, people like George Soros, the drive to provoke Russia, to block Russia, to keep Russia down, doesn't have just to do with things that Russia may have done. It has to do with what Russia could do, with the potential, and in particular, since 1998, because during the 1990s, Russia was down. You know, Russia, like Georgia today, had what you could call a George Soros government up to 1996-98 period. Its economy was being wrecked. It was really on the verge of disintegrating as a great power.
This was the shock therapy policy.
Yes, and we can go through where that came from. And after 1998, ironically, after Russia experienced complete financial collapse, the default on its government bonds, after waves of hot money had poured into the country from the international markets after the George Soros hedge fund associated assault on currencies in Southeast Asia in 1997, August 17th, 1998, Russia defaulted or suspended payment on its government bonds. And in the years after that, first through the Yevgeny Primakov government, and then gradually, not all at once, through aspects of the policy of Putin, began to come back. And there was a famous speech that Putin gave as president in Munich and early in 2007, which, again, you were lied to about that, people. You were told, if you heard the news that day, that Putin had gotten up and given a Cold War speech in Munich to an audience that included John McCain, by the way, and other leading Americans. But that's not true. Putin had given a speech in which he began by quoting Franklin Roosevelt on how to avoid a world war. And he asserted that Russia is back and is not going to allow itself to be wiped off the map as a power. And that defined a potential beyond even what Putin might have achieved to that point. That potential intersects something that Mr. LaRouche has talked about so often over the last year, and that is the potential for four nations, the United States, Russia, China, India, to initiate, to become an initiating committee for a new monetary system and an economic recovery based on the collaboration of sovereign nations and growth rather than the destruction of nations through globalization. And I want to give you one more quote from the enemy side. And this came in the London Economist, which just shows you how much this potential is on the minds of those who try to gain through globalization, impoverishment of the whole world, and massive population reduction, be it through looting and starvation or through war. There was an article in the London Economist. This is the flagship weekly publication of the City of London Financial Center. Their editorial, their feature package in March 17th, 2007 issue, was on the 50th anniversary of the European Union. They included an article from the genre called Futurology, called The European Union at 100. So from projecting to the year 2057...
In the great tradition of H.G. Wells.
Exactly. They said, right, the shape of things to come.
Yeah.
They said, they depicted the European Union vanquishing both the United States and Russia after a U.S. financial collapse and an EU-instigated Russia-American nuclear showdown over Ukraine. And I just want to read it to you. Here's how they wrote it. They said, in 2057, the EU is celebrating its 100th birthday with quiet satisfaction. Predictions, when it turned 50, that is back in 2007, that the EU was doomed to irrelevance in a world dominated by America, China, and India, proved wide of the mark. A turning point was the bursting of America's housing bubble and the collapse of the dollar early in the presidency of Barack Obama in 2010. Well, they got the timing off a little, no? The In the dangerous second decade of the century, when Vladimir Putin returned for a third term as Russian president and stood poised to invade Ukraine, it was the European Union that pushed the Obama administration to threaten massive nuclear retaliation. The Ukraine crisis became a triumph for the EU, etc., and it ends up with Russia crawling to join the EU. So what are they afraid of there, the London Economist? The potential combination of America, China, India, Russia. And for those in the U.S. who think, oh, well, that would never happen, or for those in Russia, and we do have this problem, who think, well, that won't work because the United States will never get there. You have to remember how fast policy changes can be made in a time of crisis. Leandra and others on the editorial staff recently produced the magnificent historical video, 1932. And it focused on the ascendancy of Roosevelt, the tremendous fights involved in that in 1932, after a 32-year period after the assassination of President McKinley, in which one would have thought, looking at the U.S. from around the world, that our American intellectual tradition and political traditions had been eclipsed totally. So last spring, spring of 2007, when I had the privilege of accompanying Lyndon LaRouche to Moscow, what struck him and what he talked about to the Russian interviewers who put him on TV and so forth was the fact that from Putin, from others in the Kremlin, from people in the Academy of Sciences, we were hearing a refrain, Roosevelt, 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 expressing that if the United States were to come to Russia with a Rooseveltian initiative for an anti-imperial world order, for collaboration, for growth, the Russians would respond positively. And that's the potential that British geostrategists fear. That's why we see the Georgian government of George Soros and the British Empire deployed against Russia at this time.
Now, let me bring in Leandra at this point, because this is actually a very good branch point, this question of potential. And I'd like to say to our listeners, if you have questions that are relevant to this topic, please send them in. You can send an email to us at radio@larouchepub.com. radio@larouchepub.com. And LaRouche Pub is also where you can go to get some of the coverage in the upcoming EIR, but to get the full coverage, you have to get a subscription. And to do that, you can contact us through the website. Now, Rachel and Leandra, you just raised this question of the potential of Russia that was restored with or brought back into potential with Putin's emergence at the end of the 1990s. There was a previous branching point, which was 1989. And Leandra, you're working with a team of people putting together a new video documentary on what happened around 1989 when Lyndon LaRouche intervened at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union. What can you tell us about what you're doing with that, Leandra?
Oh, well, first of all, it's a very exciting project. We hope to have it up on the LaRouche PAC website by either the start of the convention or hopefully right before. So you should tune into LaRouche PAC for that. But
instead of Obama's Nuremberg rally. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay. But there was a certain irony in what Rachel brought up, the article from The Economist where they're saying, oh, well, this... the article from The Economist and also the response of certain Russians and even certain Americans, the skepticism about LaRouche's four powers perspective. And there was similar skepticism around the potential for absolutely reshaping U.S.-Soviet relations back in really the heat of the Cold War. And that occurred that the dramatic policy shift occurred March 23, 1983, when President Reagan announced that he was going to be going with Lyndon LaRouche's policy of a strategic defense initiative. And this shocked the circles in the Soviet Union. This shocked the circles in the United States, who had really put some effort as soon as Reagan was in the White House and collaborating with LaRouche. These circles around Reagan, Henry Kissinger especially, Leo Chern, to break that relationship between Reagan and LaRouche. Because what they saw was totally unthinkable for them, that the United States was going to change policy out of mutually assured destruction and basically wreck the British system, this British imposed system of what some people call a multipolar world, but you know, they should be honest, it was just a bipolar world. But this shock where suddenly LaRouche's policies were at the center of completely changing world history. LaRouche had put this offer for beam defense, which would beam defense is essentially nuclear beam technology that disabled nuclear missiles in flight. It didn't blow them up. It disabled them. We've published quite a bit on this over the years. Mm-hmm. But
and Rachel, this was at a point where there was an escalated tension between East and West. A lot of our younger listeners don't realize that the early 1980s there was tremendous tension, nuclear buildup in Europe, new weapon systems being built by both sides, and a whole series of potential confrontations that could have led to war.
Yes. The events of the 1970s and 80s served to illustrate another warning from Mr. LaRouche that he had actually published in a small book in that period called Why SALT Won't Work, SALT being Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. And Mr. LaRouche went through how the endless kind of ballet or minuet of arms control agreements, restrictions, anti-ballistic missile defense deals in particular, which were which dated from the 1950s relationship between then Soviet leader Khrushchev and Bertrand Russell and his circles as a strategic influence in British intelligence, how that whole process not only didn't serve as a protection against nuclear war, but made the likelihood of war greater. And that became so evident in the 1970s. Of course, this intersects the period after the breakup of the fixed exchange rate system in 1971. Remember, that was followed right 2 years later by multiple simultaneous wars in the Middle East, following by what we call the oil price hike hoax of 1974, which involved recycling, channeling of oil earnings into the offshore euro-dollar market, part of the real
controlled by the City of London.
Yes, which was a major element of pumping up the bubble whose popping we're living with today. And during the late 1970s, in that setting, you had increasingly attempts by both powers militarily to outfox the doctrine known as mutual and assured destruction, which says you can't really defend your country, you can only hold your population hostage to the other side's thermonuclear missiles, by having more accurate and forward-based nuclear systems that could carry out what was called a first strike, that is, total surprise attack, wipe out the other side's strategic capacity before they could retaliate. This was associated with the Jimmy Carter period, the ascendancy of the so-called Trilateral Commission, founded by David Rockefeller, which had both Republicans and Democrats on it in the United States, as well as some of the future EU empire types of people from the European side that we're dealing with today.
Okay, now to get back to then the thread that Leandra was developing. Leandra, what happened? I think it's absolutely right. There was skepticism around the potential to change, and then overnight Reagan went with LaRouche's policy. What happened after that? Why didn't that work? And how did that lead into the 1989 situation?
Well, basically, it didn't work because the Soviets rejected it. I was talking with Rachel the other day, and she sort of gave me the profile of the Soviet leader at the time, Andropov. And there was a fishbowl mentality where, you know, you can imagine these leaders who believe that their power, the power of their nation, is caught up, is determined entirely by this set of strategic relationships, which were completely insane. So the Soviets rejected Reagan's offer for cooperation on these new physical principle technologies, first on the basis that there were certain inherent problems in the Soviet economy, and they were concerned that because of an inability to integrate new technologies into their economy, the United States, a revived United States, like what we saw under Roosevelt, what we saw under Kennedy, would they'd outstrip them, and so the Soviets, on that assumption, said, as Rachel just said, they went for full-out first strike capability, and you know there's a certain tendency, I guess, in Soviet history to just churn the economy to the breaking point.
And of course, Leandra, as LaRouche had warned them, and he was in touch, on behalf of himself, but with the knowledge of the Reagan administration, he served as what was called a back channel in sounding out the potential of the cooperation. And when he got the word, quote, from the highest level, unquote, that is from Andropov circles, that they were not going to go with this cooperation, LaRouche warned them, if you try to put your economy, your militarized economy, into a surge mobilization to get a first strike or counterstrike capability before the SDI could be in place, you'll break the back of your economy, you'll break the back of the Eastern European economies, Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, on which you depend for your military, and that'll be the end of your empire. And LaRouche said that'll happen to you within 5 years. That was based on his estimation of the process of strain of a kind of Spartan militarized economy in the Soviet bloc. It happened in 6 years. And that great, you know, the Soviet Union came to an end. And LaRouche said at that point, that's the first shoe to drop. The second shoe that's going to drop will be the end of the Anglo-American financial empire, and that will bring us back to a strategic threat. Unless we change the agenda.
Okay, now to go back to changing the agenda and the potential, there was a potential still, in spite of this, in 1988-89 that LaRouche put forward that could have avoided what we've seen over the last two decades.
He remade his proposal to the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan was absolutely committed to Lyndon LaRouche's policy. The White House was absolutely committed to Lyndon LaRouche's policy. But while they really still had the chance in 83, they also had the delusion, oh, you know, it won't really happen. You know, LaRouche can't really be right. But by 1989, you know, that delusion was absolutely crushed.
And of course, Reagan was no longer president. LaRouche, the breakup of the Eastern European bloc was 1989, of the Soviet Union per se in August 91. And I remember Lyndon putting out a warning in December of 1991 saying that if Yeltsin, the president of Russia, and his incoming government adopt the radical deregulation shock therapy, meaning decontrol of prices overnight, privatization very quickly, policies being thrust upon them by the Harvard Business School, the Chicago School of Economics, the International Monetary Fund, etc., then there will be such devastation of Russia's economy that we will again be back to a strategic threat.
And Rachel, let me just ask you this, because I'm sorry to interrupt you, but as LaRouche said that, he understood something about the intention of the people pushing those policies. The shock therapy was not intended to enable Russia to develop into a post-Soviet industrial power, was it?
No, it was intended to accomplish what was described in that Defense Department memo under Cheney, which is to prevent Russia from ever being a strong nation again. And also, remember, this is taking place still in the post-1971 bubble world, in which the bubble requires ever greater sources of loot. And if you look at the expansion of the international dope trade, you look at raw materials flows, you look at cheap labor flows, the creation of a huge cheap labor pool out of the Eastern Europe, which is now all over the Middle East and especially Western Europe and so on. This part of the world has been one of the biggest sources of loot to sustain the bubble since then. So that was their agenda. And just so we don't lose it in our time frame, since George Soros has been the owner of the government of Georgia for all intents and purposes, Soros, not alone, but as representative of these London-centered financial interests, was right in the thick of it, funding the takeover for a period of 6-7 years of Russian economic policy by young agents of this destructive policy. Soros financed the trips of young economists to the International Monetary Fund meetings from Russia in 1990. Some of these people had been groomed by Lord Harris of High Cross, the head of the London Institute of Economic Affairs, since 1983, when, again, in the wake of the Andropov rejection of the SDI, such British strategists saw a potential for change and regime change in the Soviet Union, and they cultivated through seminars abroad and junkets in which people like George Soros funded the travel, they cultivated a small group of economists who would go in and fund that policy. Later on, the same thing happened throughout Eastern Europe, and what we're looking at in the case of Georgia is as a result of what are sometimes called the color revolutions. The Rose Revolution in 2003 in Georgia, the Orange Revolution in 2004 in Ukraine, is the creation the synthesis of capabilities, not in the interests of democracy. My goodness, looking in the case of Georgia, we should just be clear that Mr. Saakashvili has been opposed by tens of thousands of people in the street for months last fall, for example, because of vote fraud and vote suppression in the Georgian parliamentary elections.
Boy, that sounds a lot like what Soros did with the caucuses in the Democratic primaries this year.
Well, there are so many similarities, Harley. I heard some on-the-ground reports from the LaRouche Youth Movement activists and LaRouche PAC activists who were involved in the caucuses in Texas, for example, and what they described with the kind of flash mob, you know, sudden deployment for change, rally for change for Obama, and then all of a sudden everybody disappears, and there's nobody sitting down to deliberate on policy. When I heard that report, I said, wait a minute, I know about that. That's what happened in Ukraine. That's what happened in Georgia. A friend of mine in Russia in 1996 came across a little handout from the International Republican Institute. This is part of the U.S. National Endowment for Democracy. Mm-hmm. And this was a brochure distributed by the IRI to instruct Russians, who, after all, had no experience with democratic elections, to conduct election campaigns. And the authors of the brochure instructed the youth organizers who were distributing this, quote, "You should be able to express your world outlook in three sentences and an idea in three words," close quote. And my friend...
Open chain.
Exactly. And my friend who was describing this said, now look, that was 1996. This actually is also in an EIR article dated February 11th, 2005 on the synthetic revolutions in Ukraine and Georgia. And he said, well, a decade has gone by and now you don't need three words, you only need one. And you don't need the world outlook, you just need to dress yourself in whatever color people have been instructed to wear, whether it's orange, green, pink, or whatever, and go out in the street and shout the single word, whether it's "pora" in Ukraine or "kamara" in Georgia. Now, this is so relevant because when we look at the Georgian regime, the EIR this week has an article by Michelle Steinberg, who I think very aptly calls Mr. Saakashvili a wholly owned test tube baby of the British Empire. And she goes through the funding of the government. I mean, literally, George Soros's foundation has channeled money into Georgian government officials at all levels, ostensibly to keep them from being corrupt. And you go through the background of the creation of that government, and you see that the young kind of activists who spearheaded the Rose Revolution in 2003 were put through a training process. It involved their going to Serbia, where this flash mob technique had been pioneered, and learning the techniques and taking them back back to Georgia. And there are whole think tanks in Britain and in the United States, such as the Albert Einstein Institution at Harvard University, where Professor Gene Sharp specializes in what he calls the politics of nonviolent action. But it's techniques that, you know, people like real nonviolent political activists like Mahatma Gandhi would turn over in their grave if they saw what they were being invoked for. And actually, the patrons of these campaigns have drawn the parallel, this is in publications, think tank discussions of these techniques, between this political approach and what's called viral marketing. Do you know that term?
Oh, sure.
This is from the whole
internet
pop music school, where there's a viral marketing is used to create a buzz about a new CD, for example.
So on the internet, a so-called idea goes out, they say it goes viral, that it's just picked up and spread.
Right. Well, the people who do this actually don't believe ideas exist. You'll probably remember, Harley, in 1995, Lyndon LaRouche wrote an article in the EIR called "The Case of the Inedible Professor."
Right.
This was about Professor Dawkins, who says that the belief in God is a virus.
Well, now, this is very interesting because I think that you mentioned the worldview, the three words, the techniques that were involved, and the Soros money, ample amount of money made by this financial predator. Maybe, Leandra, we should put something out on Obama being the Saakashvili of the United States.
I don't think that would be terribly inaccurate.
And we were talking at the beginning about this question of truth, and the truth is the first casualty in this kind of war. I want to come back, because we only have a little more than 10 minutes, I want to come back to the situation as it exists in Georgia today, because we are seeing continued psychological warfare, an effort to blame Russia for the crisis. But one of the things you brought up, Rachel, which I thought was fascinating, is the idea that Russia would back down, that the power of NATO, the expanded NATO, would cause the Russians to back down. And what Lyndon LaRouche pointed out is that Putin had no option, and he did what he had to do. And this is something that is supposedly the cause of the war danger, not the provocations. I wonder if you could just say a couple things about that.
Yes, I think we should just quickly refer to two aspects of history, one old and one current. The current is Kosovo. We haven't mentioned that, but it's so important. And just to say that Mr. LaRouche has warned repeatedly, he put out a statement right at the beginning of this year when Kosovo, the province within Serbia, was about to declare independence, and that was backed by NATO and by the U.S. He put out a warning. He said, keep Richard Holbrooke out of the area, the ex-State Department official who has a very a nasty record in terms of the conflict within the Balkans area. And he warned of the effect of the Kosovo independence because of the Russia-Serbia many centuries-long historical relationship of leading to provocations elsewhere. Well, obviously, since British strategists and British-linked strategists like Ivan Krastev of Bulgaria were explicitly saying that's what was going to happen, this warning was apt. Mr. Krastev called Kosovo the crisis that the EU needs in order to prove itself as an empire, get Russia out of any role that it might be playing in the former Soviet area under UN auspices or any auspices. And that, in fact, is what's going on, what was going on right around Georgia. Just to go with the recent history, when the Soviet Union broke up, these different republics like Georgia, Georgia, again, had been part of the Russian Empire since 1801. The area of the Caucasus was a stomping ground for empires going back to the Persians 2,500 years ago. In the 18th century, Georgia, which is an old and independent culture, one of the first Christian nations of Europe, Georgia was devastated repeatedly by marauding from both Persian and Turkish Ottoman imperial forces. And one of the kings of Georgia, in desperation, sought protection under Russia. It became part of the Russian Empire. But in 1991, Georgia was independent again. But there was the question of these autonomies. And the autonomous areas were inherited from the Soviet so-called nationalities policy that Joseph Stalin had for somewhat defensive reasons, and very problematic policy the way it was framed. But the first post-Soviet president of Georgia, Gamsa Khurdia, and this is something that's not even ever mentioned in the media, really, in the last 2 weeks, though it's so relevant, his people very quickly said, no more autonomies, no more special privileges for the authorities or the population in South Ossetia or Abkhazia. These are Caucasus mountain areas. They're also very old cultures. The Ossetians are ethnically different from the Georgians and from the Russians. The Ossetian language is actually in the same language group as Persian and Dari, right, some of these Afghan languages. But and Ossetia, because there had been a North Ossetia and a South Ossetia in the Soviet period, ended up half in Georgia and half in Russia. And when the Tbilisi, that's the capital of Georgia, when the Gamsa Khurdia regime, I mean, some of his associates used the phrase Georgia for the Georgians. In other words, don't tell me you're an Ossetian. Don't tell me you should have, you know, Ossetian language schools or anything. You're just going to be part of Georgia. People resisted in Ossetia. There's also, as you know, a culture of kind of clan, land control, social relations. There was a very quick move into fighting a brutal civil war in both that kind of north-central part of Georgia and also the west northern part of Georgia on the Black Sea around Abkhazia. Thousands of people killed. The Ossetian situation was kind of cooled out by 1992. The Abkhazia.
When did you say Russian peacekeepers came in?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And Abkhazia by 1994. And in each case, the two cases are somewhat different. There was an arrangement made at that time under the auspices of the CIS, Commonwealth of Independent States. It was the Association of the Former Soviet Republics, of which Georgia has been a member, though Saakashvili says he's now quit it. That's not entirely clear. So there were peacekeeping forces set up of combined Georgian and Russian units in South Ossetia. In the case of Abkhazia, the peacekeeping arrangement ultimately received the endorsement of the United Nations. There is a UN observers group there. One of the things the EU people have been trying to do is to replace the UN-sponsored Russian peacekeepers with EU or NATO peacekeepers. You can see.
I just want to emphasize that, because we're down to under 5 minutes and we sort of have to wrap it up. But the Russian peacekeepers were there under UN mandate, right?
That's in Abkhazia. In South Ossetia, they were there under the mandate or of the CIS and the OSCE, Operation for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
Right. And so what we've been discussing on this whole program, and I'd urge our listeners to get your friends to listen to this. It'll be archived on the LaRouchePub.com website under the LaRouche Show. There's absolutely crucial information. And Rachel, I'm going to come back to you for a summary in just a moment as to what you expect will happen and what LaRouche is saying. But Leandra, in a minute or two, when will this 1989 video be out, and what will be the benefit for people in watching it?
Well, essentially, the benefit is going to be to my generation, especially the youth generation, who know virtually nothing about current history. And LaRouche basically commissioned this for that reason, that in order to understand the point that we're at in history right now, we have to see where we came from. A lot of young people have the idea that something happened to us, something, you know, September 11th happened to us, and then everything changed from that point on. And that's not accurate. There's actually nothing in the experience of people my age that explains current history. But where we are at a point now where LaRouche has put the solution to the present crisis on the table for decades. And so we're at one of these moments like 1989 where we can still make a decision. You know, the ghost of Margaret Thatcher isn't going to determine our fate at this point.
The living dead ghost of Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, exactly.
And Leandra, when do you think this will be out? In the next couple of days, so people should be looking on the LaRouche Pack website for it.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be up in the next few days. And right now we have a new posting by LaRouche's wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche, called New Cuba Missiles Crisis in Europe. Are we heading towards World War III? So that's available right now on the website.
Okay. Now, Rachel, we have just a little more than 2 minutes. Give us a quick summary. What do you think has to be done to stop World War III?
That's great. Leandra just cited the exact article I was going to cite. Before we went on the air, Harley, I was finishing off a package of supporting material for the EIR-published version of Helga Zepp LaRouche's article, where she says either there is an immediate halt to the imperial geopolitics-driven provocations against Russia, such as the attack on South Ossetia, by the puppet regime, the British puppet regime in Georgia, and so forth, or the strategic situation could very escalate into World War III. And I think we document extensively what those further provocation points are. Azerbaijan is involved. Ukraine is involved. It's very dangerous. I think we have to be focused on bringing back the lost opportunity of 1989. And I think that the place where people can get a tremendously inspiring as well as urgent picture of how that can happen is in Mr. LaRouche's July 22nd webcast, where he talks about the need for the United States to initiate the new monetary system, new economic system, ending geopolitics and war, and going with a development perspective, anti-imperial, under sovereign nation states.
And this is in keeping with the best traditions of the United States, which came out of this Leibnizian perspective, the idea of physical economy, gee, there's so much more we could have talked about that's also in a new paper Mr. LaRouche's writing. Rachel, thank you very much for being with us today. Leandra, thank you. Get on the EIR website, the LaRouchePub.com and LaRouchePack.com. Your life depends on it. This has been the LaRouche Show. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.